details in the card now, so.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
More than space on it.
And when I hit this, it's going to play.
Just right here. Record.
Oh, record here. Okay.
Start this out. It's 9 hours recording time. I think you'll be okay.
So you all can talk. All right. Thank you, Ryan.
Absolutely.
So, and if I think everything is okay, but if I need you,
let me know. I'll be out here.
And if not, we'll just go with the audio. If there's something happens with the video, we have a couple of streams going on, so we should be able to get something.
I'll be here about 12:40. I introduce myself.
Yes.
Good stay. Good luck with dinner.
Thank you.
I can pull this in front for you.
Yes. And I'll leave this like this. So I'll start. Good afternoon. We are at San Diego State University Library. We're interviewing Mrs. Ardell Matthews and Dr. Robert Matthews for the Oral History Project. Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. Matthews.
Good afternoon to you.
And I am going to allow you to tell your story. I think it's a story that our students, our faculty, our researchers here at the library would like and would need to know about the contributions African Americans have made in San Diego. And I think it's, I just saw the movie Hidden Figures, and I think I look at a lot of African Americans in San Diego as hidden figures. People don't know the contributions you continue to make here. And that's why I want to capture these stories and have it available for anyone who would like to know what African Americans are and have done here in San Diego to make it a better place and continue to do. So I'm going to start with Mrs. Matthews, and I want you to tell your story. And if there's something, I want you to feel comfortable. If there's something that Mrs. Matthews saying, Dr. Matthews, that you want to jump in, that's okay, and vice versa. So I want it sort of like a conversation.
I hope that we can make it short enough or long enough because we've lived a very long time.
Exactly, and I'm so glad. And you continue to do things. That's what is so, it's inspirational. It makes me want to get up and do more and contribute more.
Well, that's why you are here.
That is true.
You use your life to work in the kingdom.
Yes, it is.
To help others.
Right.
To take care of your community and your neighbors. That's why we are here.
Okay.
And so we willingly do that. Even though we get tired, that's pretty sometimes we sit down and fall asleep.
Right.
That's just the way it works.
Yeah. So tell us about your early life, your family background, your childhood and schooling.
I'm Ardell Matthews. And I was Ardell Dunlap when I came into this world. I was born in a town called Arkadelphia, Arkansas. And then my mother moved to Cotton Plant, where her mother was. And so she raised her children of four in Cotton Plant, Arkansas. And we attended the Arkadelphia Cotton Plant Academy. It was a Presbyterian mission school and very close-knit people, children, faculty, staff. It was a wonderful experience and the education that I received there, I'm very proud of it, even though it was a segregated community and school. We learned and were able to go to college through the Presbyterian Church. I also had an opportunity when I was very young. My aunt came and visited my mother in Cotton Plant, and she said, I'd like to raise one of your children. And so she said, is it okay to take Ardell? And so I went to Philadelphia. I was there for 5 years. And that's where I started my education. I had not been to school before. Not because it wasn't available to me, but it's just that we waited until you were at least 6 years old. And so
When were you in Philadelphia? What? How old were you when you moved to Philadelphia with your aunt?
When I went to Philadelphia, I was 6 years old.
Oh, okay.
And it was in South Philly. Now South Philly has just changed altogether when I visited there. And then at the academy, I met wonderful teachers. Aline Greer, I remember well, Dorothy Smith, and Reverend Dwight Davis, who was a Presbyterian minister, but he was also the principal. And in that town, growing up segregated, we knew, can I say, we knew where our place was. We did not move out of it. When I was there, people came to town on Saturdays to buy their groceries, and the sidewalks were...
That's been formatted, so there's nothing else on the card now. So,
oh, wonderful.
Okay, more space on it.
And when I hit this, it's going to play.
Just right here to record.
Oh, record here. Okay.
Starting stuff. Okay. 9 hours recording time. I think you'll be okay.
Then you all can talk. All right. Thank you, Ryan.
Absolutely.
So, and if I think everything is okay, but if I need you,
let me know. I'll be out here.
And if not, we'll just go with the audio. If something happens with the video, we have a couple of strings going on, so we should be able to get something.
Cool. I'll be here at about 12 for you.
I introduce myself.
Yes.
Good stay. Good luck with dinner.
Thank you.
I can pull this in front for you.
Yes.
And I'll leave this like this. So we won't.
So I'll start. Good afternoon. We are at San Diego State University Library. We're interviewing Mrs. Ardell Matthews and Dr. Robert Matthews for the Oral History Project. Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. Matthews.
Good afternoon to you.
And I am going to allow you to tell your story. I think it's a story that our students, our faculty, our researchers here at the library would like and would need to know about the contributions African Americans have made in San Diego. And I think it's, I just saw the movie Hidden Figures, and I think I look at a lot of African Americans in San Diego as hidden figures. People don't know the contributions you continue to make here. And that's why I want to capture these stories and have it available for anyone who would like to know what African Americans are and have done here in San Diego to make it a better place and continue to do. So I'm going to start with Mrs. Matthews, and I want you to tell your story. And if there's something, I want you to feel comfortable. If there's something that Mrs. Matthews saying, Dr. Matthews, that you want to jump in, that's okay, and vice versa. So I want it sort of like a conversation.
I hope that we can make it short enough or long enough, because we've lived a very long time.
Exactly, and I'm so glad. And you continue to do things. That's what is so, it's inspirational. It makes me want to get up and do more and contribute more.
Well, that's why you are here.
That is true.
To use your life.
Yeah.
To work in the kingdom.
Yes, it is.
To help others.
Right.
To take care of your community and your neighbors. That's why we are here.
Okay.
And so we willingly do that. Even though we get tired, that's ridiculous. Sometimes we sit down and fall asleep. You know, that's just the way it works.
Yeah. So tell us about your early life, your family background, your childhood and schooling.
I'm Ardell Matthews. And I was Ardell Dunlap when I came into this world. I was born in a town called Arkadelphia, Arkansas. And then my mother moved to Cotton Plant, where her mother was. And so she raised her children of four in Cotton Plant, Arkansas. and we attended the Arkadelphia Cotton Plant Academy. It was a Presbyterian mission school and very close-knit people, children, faculty, staff. It was a wonderful experience, and the education that I received there, I'm very proud of it, even though it was a segregated community and school. We learned and were able to go to college through the Presbyterian Church. I also had an opportunity when I was very young. My aunt came and visited my mother in Cotton Plant, and she said, I'd like to raise one of your children. And so she said, is it okay to take Ardell? And so I went to Philadelphia. I was there for 5 years. And that's where I started my education. I had not been to school before. Not because it wasn't available to me, but it's just that we waited until you were at least 6 years old. And so...
Where were you in Philadelphia? What, how old were you when you moved to Philadelphia with your aunt?
When I went to Philadelphia, I was 6 years old.
Oh, okay.
And it was in South Philly. Now South Philly has just changed altogether when I visited there. And then at the academy, I met wonderful teachers. Aline Greer, I remember well, Dorothy Smith, and Reverend Dwight Davis, who was a Presbyterian minister, but he was also the principal. And in that town, growing up segregated, we knew, can I say, we knew where our place was. We did not move out of it. When I was there, people came to town on Saturdays to buy their groceries, and the sidewalks were filled with people, and the children could not pass through. We had to go out in the street and walk and go wherever we wanted to because there were so many people there. On one time, I'm walking along, and so many people are there. I'm looking where I'm going and not really, and the little boy, he's looking where he's going and not really, and he's a little white guy. And we bump into each other, and his mother looks up and she says, "Nigga, why don't you watch where you're going?" Very hurtful, but I'm in the South, and my reaction is just to look and walk on. But that's the South that I grew up in. And then I had an opportunity to go to college, the College of Emporia in Emporia, Kansas. And in Emporia, Kansas, I met wonderful people, young people, who it was mainly a white college. And in that college, there were about four or five who were African-American. And so they who were there, they brought us all together. We were in clubs together. We went to church together. They did not look at us and say we were different. And we didn't even feel different either because of the way we were treated. And so in college, what happened was a wonderful thing. On the bus from town, there was a young man, and he came over and he said, "Do you know?" And he named the professor at Arkansas A&M in Pine Bluff. And I did not know this person. And his name was Robert Matthews. That's how I met my husband in Emporia, Kansas.
Okay.
And when we dated, we walked the streets and looked in the store windows because we didn't have any money to do anything else.
Okay.
And finally, I graduated after 4 years, and he graduated after 4 years. And we were married in 1952. So
you were both still in Kansas at the time?
We were both in Kansas. But we went to Cotton Plant, Arkansas, and got married. That was my hometown. And from there, we went to Kansas City because he had a job teaching in Kansas City, Missouri. And that was the time that you had to go to the military. And once we were in Kansas City and we were married, he still had to go to basic training. And he was in basic training for that first part of our marriage. But it was a time of learning each other and learning what is expected of married young people. And a little boy came to us in the military hospital, and I am so glad I had him in the military hospital because we didn't have any money. He was in basic training. And the whatever he got, he saved for me because he got whatever he wanted from the military, but I had to get my food, pay for the rent and all of that, and take care of this little boy.
So where was basic training?
In Fort Sill, Oklahoma.
Oklahoma.
Yes. I'm glad that I had him in Fort Sill because of not having any money. But I didn't know anything about having a baby in training. And the nurse showed me how to put the baby to the breast.
Right.
And I was there 6 days. Can you imagine what it is like now? It's about, what?
3 hours.
And they dismiss you.
Right, yes.
But yeah. That was a very wonderful learning experience. But we did have to pay for our food. And our first son was $10.30. That let me get out of the hospital. That's all that I paid for him. And then the next child came. It was like $100 in San Diego. And then the next one is like $200. You see how all of the
exactly.
times change and the cost increases. So here we are in military. And he decides, Bob, my husband, decides that he would like to get his master's. And he writes to the commander, and they agree that if he had a university that accepted him, he could do so. And that university was Columbia University
in New York.
And from there, after his short teaching experience in Kansas City, we go to Philadelphia again, and I stay with my aunt, and he goes to the University of Columbus to get his master's. Then from there, what do we want to do? We want to stay in Philadelphia. It was a wonderful time because they had so many wonderful cultural experiences. And at that time, they were on free, all of their wonderful museums and the orchestra and the plays.
What year? Sorry,
that
those.
Year was 53.
54. 55.
Okay.
54, 55. That year. A great time to enjoy each other, to enjoy Philadelphia. From there, we came to, got a chance to go to San Diego. San Diego at that time was beginning to grow, and they needed teachers. So recruiters would go to these universities and recruit teachers, and that's what happened. Recruiter came to Columbia University and recruited Bob. So where do you want to go? We wanted to come to California, but not to Los Angeles because we both come from small towns. I'm from Cotton Plant, Arkansas. He's from Tonganoxie, Kansas. So let's go to this tiny little town close to the border. And that was San Diego. So we came to San Diego, and it did seem at the time like a tiny little country town. Everybody knew each other. But newcomers, we had to make friends with those who were newcomers because it was hard to meet those who lived in San Diego all of their lives. Finally going to churches, we began to meet other people. We joined the Presbyterian Church at that time. It was called Golden Hill Presbyterian Church. And Reverend Smith had been designated as founder of the church in San Diego, California.
At Reverend George Walker Smith?
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he was in seminary. And we met him and his family because he was Presbyterian, we were Presbyterian, and we joined the church just after he organized Christ United Presbyterian Church. They organized in December, and that following July, we joined the church.
That was 1956?
56.
December of 1956.
It was organized in 56. We joined in 57, July of 57.
And we began to work in the church, helping to establish a Presbyterian Association. It was called then Presbyterian Women's Association. But now we call it Presbyterian Women. And then I've always sung in the choir. I sang while I was in college. Enjoyed that. I sang when I was in the academy in Cotton Plant. And I learned to play the piano was when I was in Cotton Plant at the academy. So all of that helped me to enjoy and love and want to sing. And so I joined the choir. So now we've changed. We merged with Christ United. We merged with Brooklyn Heights Presbyterian Church. And
in San Diego?
In San Diego. That was Brooklyn Heights Presbyterian Church. And with the Presbyterian Church, Christ United, Presbyterian Church became one. And we have been in the church ever since, working in it, going to different seminaries, going to Presbyterian meetings, being involved with Presbyterian women, and assisting with anything that is necessary for the church to be a church. I've been an elder. I've worked as the president of the choir, and in any other capacity that we deem and that the session that the church, the congregation itself, deems it is needed. And so we've helped it all of that time. I would like to say too, that once we got into San Diego, we saw the need to be involved in the community. There were things, and there still are things that the infrastructure needs. There's still housing. There's still streets that need to be repaired. There's still, even now, there are sidewalks that are not where they are, where they should be. And so I am a member of the Choyas U Neighborhood Council. And I plan that agenda. I create a flyer and I walk the neighborhood and stick that flyer in the door to get neighbors to come. Sometimes three are there, sometimes 14. But my idea is let's be proactive for the things that we know that our community needs. And so that's where you come to express yourself. There is no need of us fighting about what we know we are entitled to. Let's talk about it first and go down and speak to power about what is needed in our community.
How often do you meet?
We meet once a month at the Malcolm X Library. And then we meet every other month for the San Diego Tema Sister City Society. I am also a member of the Rady's Children's Hospital Auxiliary. And what does the auxiliary do but raise money for the hospital? But we also have a child, which we take care of. The child is in the part of the hospital where he is incapacitated. But we buy clothes for them, the clothes that they suggest that we buy.
Right.
And if there is something that that child needs, our unit, Southeast San Diego Cluster Unit, we provide for that child. If I don't think that, well, Candy, we can't do that. Mm-hmm. We celebrate the birthday. We come with balloons, but we can't leave the balloons because that is detrimental to the child. We don't know what would happen to that child.
How old is the child?
He was 14. He just passed. We were getting a new child.
Oh, okay.
He was 14.
So it's like adopting in the hospital.
That's right. We adopt them. And I think other units might do the same thing because the hospital has 32 units like that all over San Diego. But ours is the Southeast unit. And those, then I'm on the San Diego Encanto planning. Now, we, in San Diego planning, it's called the Encanto planning. It's a branch of the San Diego Planning Department. We might advise them of people who are wanting to build into our community. And, or we do not appreciate what is coming into our community. Here we can express ourselves of what does not need to be in our community. If we see something most unusual, we can say that. Because the council sends a representative, the state sends a representative, the county sends
to your meetings.
To our meetings, yes. Not only to the Encanto planning meeting, but also to the Choyasu Neighborhood Council. They come, express themselves on what is it that we need, and we can tell them what it is that we need. And
so it's really community dialogue.
The representative, so does Miss.
And Dr. Weber, is Dr. Shirley,
yes,
Weber?
That's right.
And she's the assembly.
Cole is the representative, yes.
And Ms. Cole is
Myrtle
Cole, who's
the current. The department sends a representative. The police department sends a representative. The county.
Supervisor.
Oh, Supervisor Cox, yes. He sends a representative. So they're there for our neighbors to express themselves of what they need in the community. And right now, we are working with a firm contractor about a lot that's been in our neighborhood for 30 years, and we're looking for that because they're constantly wanting to put low housing. That's okay. We need it. But let's vary the diet. Let's have enough housing for all of us. Teachers can't live there if they build those kinds of housings. Right. Neither can police officers. Neither can those who are up with mobile. They can't. But we are sticking to our desire. Mm-hmm. Let's have a varied amount of development. Something for the young people. Seniors too. Restaurant. We're understanding that there's a tech shop that wants to go in there, and we surely hope so that that happens.
So you're looking at it like a multiple use development sort of.
That's
like
right.
That. Okay.
Yes, that's correct. And so I'm very involved in that. Plus, I do have a home.
Yes.
I did have three wonderful young men, Mark, Brian, and Scott. Mark is no longer with us, but Brian is here, and he is busy with the little ones. He works as a teacher in Linda Vista with the little ones, and then he has his own, the Matthews Company, DJing.
Okay.
He does weddings, dances. He does the parade. He's just very involved all over that. And Scott is in Los Angeles, and he flips houses.
Okay.
So we are very blessed in so much of our lives. And to be here this long to be able
Absolutely.
To even tell our story. We are very thankful that you have, San Diego State University has this oral history project going, that someone will hear our story and be inspired to perhaps carry on from where we are.
Exactly.
Because we are where we are because of someone before us had that idea, and we're looking at, because yes, it's true. We start on the backs of somebody else.
It's true.
I know that we not would not be able to, I would not have been able to go to college if my teacher had not said, you can go to a Presbyterian college. And so that has happened.
I was going to ask, did you go on a Presbyterian scholarship to college?
Yes, I did. I did. So I feel that that's a gist of my story so far. One of the things, too, that I would say, when I had my young people in school, I taught at Sherman Elementary in my beginnings. Wonderful young people, I enjoyed that. I started with second grade, and then each year I'm going to another grade, third, fourth, and then I had
How long did you teach at Sherman Elementary?
14 years.
Oh, okay.
And then I went to San Diego School of Creative and Performing Arts, and I retired from there. And that was a wonderful experience. We started with fourth graders, and it's a magnet school, and the young people, they feel that they're all going to be stars. We did get some stars out of that school, but anyway, they want to come. And another thing, we really had the support of the parents. We had tours for them to come to see what is happening. And they were free to come into the classrooms whenever they came on campus. So that part of my teaching, I enjoyed. So
what years were you at a teacher? What were the years?
I started in 1964, and I retired in 1996. Yes.
I never knew you were a school teacher. I don't know why I didn't know that. Wonderful.
Yes.
So you always had a love for children.
I do. I do. I really like them. But thank God I do.
Yes.
And I say, too, thank God for fathers. Because our sons, they grew up, we didn't have a lot of problems with them.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing about, they wanted to go out, you know, and we'd say no. And then they became like teenagers, and we would take them to the parties. They'd stay in the car. They would not get out. Because the young people at the party, sometimes they're out on the steps. They're walking into, and they did not want them to see that we bring them to the party.
What's the age differences in your sons?
5 years.
Five apart each?
That's right, yes.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah. So I felt that we needed to be able to send our young people to college. And you cannot send people to college when you have them this year, the next year, and the next year.
Right.
Yes.
Good planning.
So, we wanted some college material, and we did. And it was
wonderful.
We were happy to do that because they were nice, nice people. And so we didn't really have to sacrifice, but we worked and we were able to send them to college. And we feel that that's another of our blessings that we have.
Well, Mrs. Matthews, thank you. And as I said, you can contribute to Dr. Matthews' message. Dr. Matthews, this is Dr. Robert Matthews. You can introduce yourself.
Okay. I've learned from practice with this young lady, if you don't interrupt
her. Okay.
Okay. Well, I was born and reared in a small Kansas hamlet called Tonganoxie, T-O-N-G-A-N-O-X-I-E, Tonganoxie. Tonganoxie is approximately 17 miles west of Kansas City, Missouri. It's about 10 miles north of Lawrence, Kansas, where the university is located. It's about 13 miles from Fort Leavenworth. It's right in the heart of what was disputed territory during the Civil War. And it has a history that is just as assorted in a negative way as was slavery, because a river, the Kansas-Missouri River, separates the two states. Missouri was a slave state. Kansas was a free state, free only in name. Because the modernist Brown versus Topeka, Kansas, was on the Kansas side of the river. And my high school was too small to have a dual system, or it would have, because Ku Klux Klan and anti-freedom groups worked, or pro-slavery, was in the area. And the net result is I went to school in a situation where I did not have a black male companionship in the same grade level until I was at the University of Kansas. In other words, my cousin and I were in a situation where throughout our school history, we were all in a white situation. Elementary and high school. We were the only, I was the only male in any of my classes. Maggie was the only female in her classes. But there were others in the school, but that's gives you an idea of how shallow we were. And the net result is that in Lawrence, you had segregated schools. In Topeka, you had segregated schools. In Leavenworth, segregated school. Kansas City, segregated school. So the net result is the African-American and Mexicans and other children call both Maggie and myself Black Anglo-Saxon, which was an honor because it referred to the fact that our pattern of speaking was what the teachers were teaching us, and our pattern of study was completely different from those youngsters in the predominantly a segregated situation. And most of our teachers were from small schools in Kansas and Missouri. And they treated us just as well as anyone else, and they treated the entire class. So we had an advantage being where we were. And the result is that in the history of that school, Tonganoxie Rural High School, Maggie went on to get her master's degree, and no one else in any of our classes did that. I went on and got my PhD, but that was because of the firmness in our study habits, mm-hmm. and we only had each other. So we studied together, and we worked together, and we worked things out.
Do you attend reunions? Have you attended any class reunions?
Yes, I have. Okay. And in 2010, our high school decided that they would have a Hall of Fame for individuals from our high school who had made a great achievement. The very first name to be inducted into the Hall of Fame was Dr. Robert Matthews.
Wonderful.
From San Diego.
That's great. Congratulations.
Now, my childhood was quite different because my mother worked as a domestic in white folks' kitchen. And so the net result is there was a white family, was Jewish, the Dykemans, that took a particular liking to our family. And the net result was that the Dykemans owned a drugstore, and just a general store. And they supplied us with books. And if there was a book that I wanted, all I had to do was tell Ed or Sarah that I would like this book. And they would see that I had the magazine or book that I needed. We had a library, but the only time you could go to the library and you could read books in the library, but you couldn't take them home if you were a person of color. We had a swimming pool.
But the whites could take the books home.
Oh, yes. We had a swimming pool, but the only time you could swim in the pool was when they were cleaning it. And usually on the day that they were cleaning the pool, you had all kinds of people swimming together, and it didn't seem to bother anyone. But that's all changed now. And many of the people who had those kind of thoughts as youngsters no longer have those kind of thoughts. Oh, but now I'll go ahead and say that my grandfather was a migratory farm worker, and he made his living working around on farm, pitching hay, shucking corn, picking potatoes, and I started working in the fields with my grandfather at the age of 7, and I could pick potatoes, and I could fill the basket, but I couldn't empty them, and I had an uncle who became my favorite uncle. And really, Floyd was responsible for us coming out to California. He was in the Navy, and he kept talking about how great California was. And so we came out here. But Uncle Floyd, once I filled the basket, I called for Uncle Floyd to come empty the basket. And I forget how much they gave us for a basket, once you filled a bushel basket. But I was at early age was picking over 100 bushels a day of potatoes.
You're picking in the Germans with it.
And in the 1940s, we were in the potato field working away, and a convoy of army trucks came onto the field, and we were told that we were to have nothing to do with these individuals, and they were some of the most beautiful men you'd ever want to see, and they all had beautiful blonde hair. Beautiful blonde
hair. This was in the potato fields?
In the potato field. And these men were German prisoners of war.
Oh.
This was during World War II. That's how old I am. They were assigned to help pick up the potatoes and do other farm labor around the farm. And they did. But in spite of the fact we weren't supposed to fraternize with any of them, we became very friendly with many of them. And, you know, the interesting thing, in the late 70s, when I was with the, active with the Urban League.
Urban League in San Diego?
The Urban League here in San Diego had a contract with the Air Force in Colorado Springs. And they sent from Colorado Springs a personnel from Colorado Springs came to San Diego to help get youngsters here in San Diego involved with the Air Force. And he took a look, this young man took a look at me, and finally he repeated my name. Well, the interesting thing about that experience was he was one of the former prisoners of war that I had met as a youngster, and he was a youngster. And here he was, an official with our U.S. Air Force, which shows you, you know, the tie that we do have.
Exactly.
And
so he had become a citizen and everything?
He had become a citizen, naturalized.
Right.
Had joined the service here.
That is
but
amazing.
When he, in the 40s, he was forced by the German government to be in the German occupation army. And so that was the kind of experience. And now, educationally, as I said, Maggie was my cousin. So I didn't even have a girlfriend locally in those days. Of course, it's okay. Maggie and I are still very, very.
Where does she live now?
She lives in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And she's a retired librarian.
Oh, okay.
Retired.
We're wonderful people.
She worked all over. She worked all over the world with the armed forces.
Okay.
She was within the armed forces. Professionally, I began my life as a teacher in Kansas City, Missouri. And I had a unique experience in Kansas City, Missouri, because one morning, Dr. Howland, who was the principal of the school, walked into my room and he says, "Mr. Matthews, you are not to mention liberty, freedom, equality in your classroom. That's an order from the Board of Education."
What year was that? And what was that elementary
was
school?
That was in 52.
And this was elementary school?
Yes, the elementary school. Booker T. Washington Elementary School, 2404. Prospect Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri.
We were newlyweds at the time.
Yeah. And the net result was that all the new teachers and the old teachers had this, but I asked immediately where the NAACP met. We weren't to have anything to do with the NAACP. And that was a command of the Board of Education at that time. Well, every new teacher decided that they weren't going to obey this rule. And I was among them. Well, the net result is the NAACP boycotted the school. And they put a picket around the school, but the teachers were allowed to go through. And they also split our classes into three separate groups. And to avoid the 3-day compulsory school law, one group would come on Monday and two groups would stay away. On Tuesday, the second group would come and two groups would stay away. So that every 3 days, so we wound up teaching the same lessons 3 days in a row at a time, 3 days. Now, during that period, President Harry S. Truman decided to call me to active duty in the Army. Well, I was informed by the principal, Mr. Howland, that I didn't have to go. All I had to do was to agree with the board down on Walnut Street, and I had to go down on Walnut Street and sign that I was needed to teach school. But I was so glad to get away from this that I told him no, I was going to go to the Army. And I went to the Army. And that's how I got in the Army. And I ran into some unique experience in the Army.
And that was at Fort, you were always, you stationed at Fort Sill, Oklahoma?
No, I was first sent to Camp Chaffee, Arkansas. And then I was sent to Fort Sill. And I was sent there for basic training as an artillery specialist because I had a science background at Emporia State Teachers College. And so I went to Fort Sill. Now in Fort Sill, they discovered my writing ability and speaking ability. So they decided to send me to the Armed Force Institution at Fort Slocum, New York. And when my son was born, the first child was born, I was not there. My wife was strictly alone because I was in New York at the School of Journalism. And I wrote a few papers for the Armed Force, Army Times. And the net result is, this led me into the post-information educational headquarters. And I was sent to Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Fort Polk?
Fort Polk, Louisiana. And at Fort Polk, Louisiana, even though I was not a commissioned officer, they provided us with housing. We had housing. And I also operated at night the information, movie theater. And my wife and I, after the movie, we would clean the theater. And we put the baby on pillow in one of the chairs. And I'd blow everything to the front of the theater. She would bag it and everything. And these kind of things. So I had some unique experience. And then after being at Fort Polk and deciding to go, I had learned to like New York, and I had seen Columbia when I was there at Fort Polk, Fort Slocum in Rochelle. I decided I was going to go to the best school, teachers training school in the country. At that time, it was Columbia. And so I wound up going to Columbia University and I graduated from Columbia in 1955 with a master's in child education. And I immediately enrolled in summer session at Temple University in Philadelphia and started working on my doctorate. And then at Columbia, I had a medical recruiter, Dr. Frank Tate from San Diego. And I wound up coming to San Diego. And that was about my life. I immediately joined the Urban League because we had difficulty here in San Diego. I was assigned to the old Frontier School, Frontier Elementary. And Frontier Elementary. Frontier Elementary was located at the entrance to what is called Loma Portal in today. Well, they were not accustomed to leasing or renting to Black people, or I should say African American. Anyway,
it was redlined.
It was redlined.
What does that mean?
Just everywhere I went.
Real estate agent.
Yeah.
They established a red line in certain sections of the city. So you could not even rent.
I couldn't rent. Couldn't buy because I didn't have the money. And the net result is I went to the school district, and Dr. Tate, when he hired me, Dr. Tate had said I would have no problem in San Diego anywhere. And if I did, come to him. So I went to him, and he said, well, he couldn't believe that I couldn't secure housing anywhere. So he said he would take care of it. And he went out and he ran into the same thing. Just as soon as he would say, in those days we were known as Negroes, right? So he would say, you know, just as soon as he'd say that this teacher was a Negro, it would be no, no, no. So he went to the Urban League, and at that time, the director of the Urban League, was a man by the name of Percy Steele, S-T-E-E-L-E, Percy Steele. And he and Percy Steele went out together, and still no results. So they decided that they would approach the city of San Diego. And the reason they were approaching the city of San Diego, the city of San Diego had two housing areas or housing projects in San Diego. One was called Aztec Villa, and that was primarily college student, and two.
Aztec.
Aztec Villa. And the other one was Frontier Housing. Frontier Housing was leased by the city to military personnel.
And those who worked in defense
projects at that time. And so they went to the city council and asked the city council to waiver the requirements that the requirements prefer the two of us so we could have a place to stay. So I live for year, well, I live for over a year in the Frontier Housing Project with the student that I actually was teaching.
Right.
And they were just amazed and just pleased that their teacher was living right amongst them. And I still have friendships from those days.
Wow.
And that
we didn't have a car.
Yes,
so I do. You were glad that you could walk to work.
Yeah. And the Aztec Villa was for?
For the students.
For college.
And Frontier Housing.
Yeah. Was for military personnel. Okay. And it was predominantly Black. Even in those days, simply because they couldn't get anywhere but in the project. So that gives you the early history, but it causes...
This was in the 60s when you were living there?
Yeah, and in
56.
56? And then in 58, we were able to buy a house, the house where we live now. We still live in the same house we first bought.
That's right.
That was wonderful. That's wise.
But then, because of Percy Still and worked hard to get us in, I became active with the Urban League. Matter of fact, I became president of the Urban League. And you mentioned Mr. Brodus. Mr. Brodus worked under my supervision when I was president of the Urban League. I met a woman who became very dear to me. She was an Anglo-Saxon. That means she was white.
Mm-hmm.
But she was very dear. Her name was Donna Salk. Donna Salk was the wife of Jonas Salk, the man who was responsible for polio vaccine. And later, I became interested in the Elementary Institute of Science there in San Diego. And Dr. Salk was a benefactor of the Elementary Institute of Science. And so I have a picture of my wife and Dr. Salk together. And one of the unique things was that one of the men in 1983, Dr. Salk spoke at, when I was honored by the Elementary Institute of Science, Dr. Salk came to speak on, be the guest speaker. And he brought an African American with him, by the name of James Norfleet, N-O-R-F-L-E-E-T. Dr. Norfleet was a chemist, African-American, and he formulated the toothpaste called Ultra Bright toothpaste. And I still use Ultra Bright today. And Dr. Fleet had an nephew here in San Diego,
Norfleet,
by the name of
Fred
Norfleet.
Fred Norfleet.
Yeah. So, I mean, and all of these things happened.
Fred Norfleet was his nephew.
His nephew. Uh-huh. But all of these things happened to me in a positive way because I was Black. If I had not been Black, none of this would have happened.
Southeast Theater.
And in 1963, in the 1950s, a group of us, and I happen to be involved in that group, a group of men and women discovered And we had a YMCA, but the YMCA didn't have a building. They didn't have really a place to call their own. And a man by the name of Fred Davies donated 10 acres of land, which was part of Greenwood Mortuary, to the YMCA. And this group of men and women decided they would build the YMCA. Now, none of us had any experience at building, but we learned awfully fast. And we had buildings brought in from the old Brown Academy in Pacific Beach.
Young people.
And we dug the trenches and everything. And today, we have a multi-million-dollar deficit going up.
Yes.
And, but we started with nothing. We started with nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the wives would bring the supper.
So they were like,
and we had camaraderie and fun, and this group of men were school teachers and probation workers, and we had.
It was an integrated group.
It was definitely integrated, and so political.
And so we're still a part of the Jackie Robinson YMCA.
Yeah.
Oh. We still support it.
Jackie Robinson
East Theater. How did that come about?
Well,
so
it's called Common Ground Theater now.
But it was originally, it was the Southeast Community Theater. And a group of us got together and decided that we would create opportunities for young people to demonstrate their acting ability. And I was in that group, and I became known as one of the co-founders of the Southeast Community Theater, which today is called the Common Ground Theater. And incidentally, the Common Ground Theater is one of the oldest acting theaters, African American theaters, in the entire United States.
Mm.
And it's been in existence since 1963. And it became formulated in 1964. That's when we got our 503 tag. And Cleavon Little, for example. Cleavon Little came out of the theater. James Avery, John Houston, John Houston. All of these names, great actors and actresses came out of the old Southeast Community Theater.
And also the parade.
Well, the parade came. Martin Luther King Jr. Parade came out in 1979 as a project by Dr. Francine Williams. She was not a doctor at the time. She was an elementary school teacher at Knox Elementary School over on 49th Street. By that time, I had become a director of education, and Francine was working under my supervision, and she had to have my approval to have a march through the community. So she called and asked if I would approve. And I said, of course, that I would approve, and the march. Well, what Francine didn't tell me at the time Well, she'd also asked other schools outside of Southeast to be participating in the march. And I was discussing the march with Tom Goodman, Dr. Tom Goodman, who was the superintendent of schools. And Dr. Goodman said he would love to lead the march. Well, I was planning on leading the march. And really, since he said he would love to do it, I said, okay, you can do it. And so he led the march. Well, Dr. David Geiger, who was president of what was called the Pacific Coast Bank on Logan Avenue, saw the march. And he said, you know, this is something that could be developed into a parade. And if someone would put it together, I will fund it. And he did. And we got a committee to working together. And that's how the Martin Luther King Jr. Parade came into being. And
who was the first parade?
The first parade?
1979.
And the first, but it was a march. And it became a parade in 1980. And Dr. Geiger died in 1981. He didn't live to see it develop the way it did. And then one day in 1987, my wife and I, Ardell and I, had become very friendly with Rufus and Mary DeWitt. Rufus was the executive director of the YMCA.
Jackie Robinson.
It was not called Jackie Robinson, the South Team at the time. So he and his wife and my wife, they got together talking, and Rufus said, for the king, for the parade, we need a king. Now, both Rufus and I were alphas, so all we were thinking about was we needed a king. And so we said, okay, next year we're going to have a king. And the two ladies said, a king is nothing without a queen. So that's how the pageant became on.
Oh, okay.
We said, well, we were going to work with the young men. We weren't going to work with the young ladies. So my wife and Mary began planning, and the pageant is still going strong today.
Yes.
And everything is at the Educational Culture Conference. Well, that gives you kind of a glimpse of some of the things we got into.
I want to say that the thing that I see as I listen, we are into things that started and they're still going. It's sustaining.
Yes.
And we want it to continue. And right now, I see the Alpha Brothers. They are really coming forward and working with the parade. They're coming forward and paying attention to the King and Queen pageant. So that's a wonderful thing to continue it.
The King and Queen pageant is the precursor to the parade, right? Mm.
Yes, that's right.
The pageant is in November and the parade is in January, yes. But they're tied together.
I'd say that for the theater, too.
One thing I wanted to, and Mrs. Matthews touched on it briefly, was Team Algona. How did that happen?
Through Mrs. Quincella Kimbrough. Wasn't that it?
Yes. Well, it began as an idea with Leon Williams.
That's true.
Leon Williams.
He wanted to have
Leon Williams, but he was a city councilman, he decided that all white groups were having their sister cities, and there was no African sister city. And so Leon Williams had the idea, and
called on Quincella.
And Quincella Kimbrough organized.
Okay. And so it's been going ever since, too.
And it's still active?
Yes, that's right.
It's just holding on. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's holding on is I'm getting tired.
You have earned to be tired.
And I'm the president. I'm the president, and my wife is the secretary. Okay?
So what kind of things do you do with the sister city? Just a brief,
With the sister cities, you try to help develop things that they feel they need. For example, one of the greatest needs of most African nations is clean water. And so Sister Cities has developed, Tim and Sister Cities has developed a well and have provided funds for the creation of clean water for Africa children.
And we support the Butcher, Vicky and Dr. Butcher, Water for Children Africa. Okay. We support that because they go every other year. And either they build a well, mm-hmm. or they maintain the well that they built already.
And they needed technical engineering advice. And Tim and Sister City sent out Kurt Cheval and others to Africa, to Tema, to help them develop.
Talk with them about roads.
Roads
and buildings.
And so forth. Okay.
So like training yes, them to do
right.
it.
Yes. Okay. And we would gather generic medicines that some of the health groups would allow, and we would send them to Ghana, and it was really a wonderful relationship. Mm-hmm. On our board, there used to be a man who worked with San Diego Gas and Electric. His name was Otto, O-T-T-O, Herr, H-I-R-R.
A-G-R-R, not H-I-R-R.
I don't think so, Bob. Okay. I think it's with an I. I think he spelled it with H-I-R-R.
Okay. I can't dispute you. I'm sorry.
I'll check on it.
And he...
I'm not going to let you know which one is the great one, though.
When we would get these things together, the city schools had new books that they were not passing out. And they would allow us to get them. Mm-hmm. And he would say, well, what do you want? He would send the trucks to city schools to pick up those books or wherever we had the generic medicines and take them down to the waterfront and put them on a boat, on a ship. Well, we can't do that. I'll tell you what we used to do. San Diego had a tuna cannery, right. Starkist Tuna. And Tema has a tuna cannery, Starkist Tuna. So the ships would come back and forth to each harbor. And all we had to do was say, we have these things that need to go. And Mr. Herr would send that truck to pick up whatever we had collected and take it down to the ship from Ghana to take it back. But now, in order to take things, to send things, we have to send it from here to New York. That's prohibitive. And then from New York to Ghana. So
and that's
we've been very slow about doing that.
Yeah.
But that's something that we did. We also would have it wasn't a festival, but like an African, we called it an African marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where
artifacts from Africa are sold and dishes that were in the cookbook that we had printed out.
Oh,
that food,
okay.
We would have that available to sell. And that was
it was like a day affair, a weekend.
It was a weekend.
Yes.
On a Sunday afternoon at the Educational Cultural Complex. Mm-hmm. We called it ECC for short. That was a great thing to do. And something else the city used to do, I don't know, maybe they still do, but I haven't seen any African dignitaries come. But people from Africa, from the country, no matter which country, it had to come from the continent. Mm-hmm. They would call us and ask us if we would host them or if we knew where they might sleep, not too expensively. And we would help out in that way.
So they would come to San Diego.
They would come to San Diego, then they would call us. They'd call Vira Williams. She would know the people, and she would call us. And that's where they would get to know African Americans here in this country. Otherwise, you see, when they come into the mainstream environment, and we are not there. So this is how we got to know some of them, and they got to know us.
Right.
We would host them.
Now you asked, one of the questions was that was asked as, what do you remember about your parents and their family background? Mm-hmm. Well, my parents were both domestic laborers, mm-hmm. but they both believed in getting their youngsters to school. And my mother, she'd get us up every morning, and if we didn't respond, she would give us a little tap, you know, we'd get out of there. And so both mom and dad insist that we get the best education possible. And my mom and dad also insist that they ask us something, we tell them the truth. Now, I can remember very distinctly that my Uncle Walter and I, there was a turtle dove that settled in the tree in our yard. And Mom had a special regard for this turtle dove because she said this dove was a sign of God. And she told Walter and me never to throw it at a dove. Well, one day, Walter, and it was Walter. He threw at the dove, and he hit the dove. And the dove dropped dead. Mm. And Mom was in the window.
Mm. That was not
and
a good
she
time.
She saw this. And she let into Walter and me. And I'll never forget that day.
Walter was her brother.
And he was my uncle. And I haven't thrown at a dove since that time. Another time, my dad had a very, very forceful language. And occasionally, he'd forget and he'd use profane language. Well, one day, Walter and I were out in the yard, and Walter did something I didn't like. And I started cursing him just the way my dad would. But I didn't know Mom was in the window listening. And so she called me over and she says, Robert, where did you learn that kind of language? And I didn't want to say Dad did it. So I said, little bird. And that really made her angry. She came out there with a switch, and she lit into. I'll never, and I've never used that phrase since. A little bird show. That was a logical thing,
right?
You know, very quickly you have to ask something. So she says, "Where did you learn that?" I wasn't going to see Dad. I said, the little bird told me.
How are we going to see about this little bird? Thank you so much.
I had my experience as a child. Remember now, I said I went to Philadelphia. So now my aunt was having problems, and she sent me back to Arkansas. Philadelphia had lights. It had inside toilets. It had a trolley cars. It was old. This was 1937, 38, 19. I got back in 1942, I think. Anyway, so I got back to Arkansas. I didn't know that that was such a cultural shock, but I talked like I was from Philadelphia. And the young people, they teased me like you wouldn't believe. So I would run behind the door and hide, and they would find me. Because I got to Arkansas, and we had those kerosene lamps. We had an outside toilet. We cooked on a wood stove. It was such a change. But one of the things that I'm glad that it happened, I grew up with my brothers and sisters. We became very, very close, and we still are. My sister is still living. But that was a real shock. Then my mother married my stepfather, and he had a farm. So we go on the farm, and what do we have to do? We have to chop cotton. We have to pick cotton. I would pick cotton, and I saw the dirt, and I would pick the dirt out of the burrs, not knowing that you're supposed to grab it and put it in your sack. Mother would pick cotton, or she did a breakfast, we did a lunch, we did a dinner. Mm. And she picked and chopped more than we did. We were just lagging behind, but one thing that happened, we didn't know that the farm was mortgaged, and we helped to pay for that after my mother married with him. Mm. And we enjoyed that because we loved the pigs. There was a rut that we loved that was, and then he grew to be this great big thing, and they took it to Memphis. We cried on that.
Did you have like days, like when you, what was I thinking about? Like, you killed the hog and had made.
We killed hog and we saw that they didn't kill ours. They took that to Memphis. They didn't let us.
Yes.
Oh, my. That's something. I did have pictures of that.
Wow.
The hog was, they let it hang upside down to let the blood
drain. Right.
And we never had a hamburger. We always had pork chops. We never had ribs. We had a barbecue sandwich or barbecue shoulder. But to have ribs, we ate those, but not barbecued. We rode horses. We had a horse. We had a mule. We had cows. And when the calves were born, they were given to us, and we would play with them and ride the calves. Mm-hmm. And that was always fun. We had a great big cottonwood tree in the field, and we made a swing out of it with tires. And we would stand on the fence that someone would throw the swing to us. And when the swing came, we'd jump on the swing and swing way out. To me, it was a happy, happy time.
Yeah, it is. It was good. Kids don't understand it now. You don't need all this stuff.
Yes.
Well, I thank you both so much. I wanted to ask a couple of like closing questions to each of you. Number one, because you've been here for a while in San Diego, what would you say is the biggest change that you've witnessed in San Diego since you've been here?
I'm Well, since we've been here, I want to say since we've been here, I see the growth. Because the tallest building was the Bank of America building. Mm-hmm. And Bank of America is no longer in that building, but it's still standing. The Bank of America building, and the other one was, I've forgotten the name, but I'll think of it. Those were the two tallest buildings. I've seen the growth, and I have seen downtown change, because it used to be nothing but parlors where the soldiers came, mm-hmm. not soldiers, sailors. They came to be tattooed parlors on both sides of that, from the railroad on up to about 9th or 10th Street.
Mm.
And I've seen that change. I've seen the people reaching out to us, Bob and I, when we were able to move out of our neighborhood. There used to be called the human resources. Wasn't that the name of it?
Human relations
resources. And they formed a committee. We weren't part of it. And we went from house to house, getting to know each other, talking to each other, to let them see each of us. But we never moved out. We stayed there. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that we did. But it was good to know that we could have had we wanted to.
Right.
The neighbors in Point Loma, La Mesa, I don't think Lemon Grove, but there were three communities in which people lived. Oh, and Del Mar. Del Mar was opening up to come and buy. They were encouraging us to buy in these different communities so that other people would get to know us. But we didn't do that. And that's a change that I have seen.
I've heard people say that. What do you think are the, Mr. Metz, what is your change?
I think Ardell very well expressed what I see in a positive way, but I'm also still seeing San Diego in a negative way.
That was going to be the next question. Next question. Yeah.
The negative thing that I see is the lack of meaningful progression in our educational system, mainly the unified school district. It is in terrible shape compared to what I became accustomed to. I do not see the compassion that really is here to move into a progressive future.
What about telling your San Diego State experience? You wanted to be an administrator, that isn't on.
Well, I have mentioned that when I came on the campus here in 56, I had a professor, I remember his name, but I'll not use it, who came to me, and I could sense he was wanting to chat with me. And he says, everyone else has gone out of class, and I'm getting ready to leave. And he says, Mr. Matthews, where are you parked? And I told him. And he says, well, I'm parked that way. I'll walk with you. And as we walk, he says, Mr. Matthews, what is your goal? And I said, I would like to eventually be an administrator. He says, well, I sense that. And he says, San Diego isn't ready for you. And he says, I hate to see you waste your time and money. Well, I thought little of it. I thanked him, and I came back, the second class that I took was under Dr. Leonard. Well, anyway, when I walked into the classroom, Dr. So-and-so was in front of the room, and I walked into the front of the room, and I sit down in the first row, and he looked at me, and he says, you should be in black, in the back. But I sense he was joking, not really serious. But then I took a seat, and then I, lady came in. She was white, of course, Margaret. He looked at her, and he says, what are you doing in my class? I don't want women in my class. And she turned and started crying and walked out of the room. And I went out. I just got up and told her to come back in and sit down. She had a right there to be there. And all through the class, he would take jabs at both of us. But then came the final day, and there were two A's granted in the class. She got an A, and I got an A. Everyone else had B's and C's.
How many? So everybody else was white males.
Yeah. Yeah.
And approximately how many were in the class?
Well, there was about pretty close to 20 of us, but they were all white male. And I was the only black male, and she was the only white woman in the class. And we got the A's.
And that was 1956.
That was in 1957. It was second class. Yeah. And it seemed like that. My third experience, I had passed all the written tests. I had passed everything here at San Diego State. I had passed every test I had passed every test that Unified School District had. And I was ready to be named an administrator in the district. And I came out here, and I had one more class to complete. And Noble Shade, Wilbur, I called him Wilbur at that time, Noble Shade was behind me. And I hand my papers for the approval of the instructor. And he looked at me, and he looked at the papers, and he put my papers aside, and he says his class was closed. And he did not take my papers. But then Wilbur, our noble, was right behind me. And Wilbur, he accepted Wilbur's paper. And I got ready to hit him. And Wilbur grabbed me.
But why wouldn't he accept your, why didn't he accept your paper? And then it was right there. Why did he think he, how could he get away with that by accepting
one?
I don't know.
I didn't know until this day. But another instructor picked up my paper. Mm-hmm. And he said he had a portion of the class that I needed, and then I was welcome in his class. I was not welcome in this guy's class for some reason. Mm-hmm. He didn't know me, but he did that. And the net result is, though, later in 1965, this man who had rejected me needed someone to be a field supervisor for the teachers' corps. San Diego had the teachers' corps. This man selected me as the field supervisor. I was on the staff during the summer.
And that was here at San Diego State.
Here at San Diego State.
Amazing.
But we had all kinds of things going on early. Mm-hmm. And that's why I said San Diego State, in its early history with me, I didn't have what you'd say was a good time here at San Diego State. I just came, did my work, but...
How long were you here?
I was here, well, I worked here for different time, different places. In 1960. When did I go to Indiana? Was it in 19, to University of Indiana? Was it in 1961 or 62? Well, in 1960, Mr. Irv McClure, who was principal of Frontier School, recommended me for Phi Delta Kappa here at San Diego State. Phi Delta Kappa had not ever initiated a person of color into the activity here at San Diego State. And Irv nominated me. Well, the surprising thing is that I was readily accepted. And not only was I accepted, I became the delegation. I became the member that the chapter here selected to send to Bloomington, Indiana, to the International Convention. And within 3 weeks, within 3 years, I was president of the Phi Delta Kappa chapter.
You were the first black
campus. Hmm?
You were the first black in that.
Yeah, I was accepted just like that.
You think it was based on because it came from McClure?
I don't know. That's the point. These things happen, and you don't really know.
Right. That's true.
I want to say we haven't said anything about Dr. King coming to San Diego.
Great.
And because of Bob's position as administrator, he was among those who got a chance to be a part of that. And I'm just tagging along, but... Dr. King came to San Diego. Mrs. King came to San Diego. Bob had an opportunity to meet with her when he was president of the Educational Cultural Complex. She spoke there. He also had an opportunity to, the people who were on the board to make California one of the recipients of the non-educational complex. All of the states did not do that immediately.
Right.
It wasn't a federal holiday. But California was one of those who was first. San Diego City Schools.
You were on the board that...
No, he was president.
President.
Yes. Well, but not on the board of the...
Here's what happened.
Okay.
I was president of the Educational Cultural Complex from 1984. To 1992. In 1985, just before the holiday became a federal day, President Ronald Reagan was against making Martin Luther King Jr. birthday a federal holiday. The California Commission for the federal holiday was attempting to meet in San Diego. They could not get any place to meet in San Diego. So I received a call from Michelle Anderson. And Michelle asked if I would be willing to host the California Commission on my campus. And I asked him the details, and he said that Coretta Scott King would be here and that she would be on the campus, and asked if I would host it. Well, I didn't need anyone to say what I should do. I said, yes, you can host it. And if the Board of Education or the community college, they had one choice. They could fire me. So I said, okay. And so she came aboard. And she appeared at the in my office one day. And I explained to her that I didn't have a separate space for, but I would split my office in half, and I would share my office with her. And we had a auxiliary phone brought in. And so I had the distinction of saying I shared a room with Coretta Scott.
That's right.
So I had that distinction. Yeah. And then,
what was she doing here? Why did she need an office? Because of her work with trying to get the holiday.
Right. And so the net result is, after that meeting, Ronald Reagan changed his mind, and he became a firm supporter of creating the holiday. Right. And he was president at that time. Yes.
At ECC? Educational conference. Mm-hmm. We've had Russians to come perform and to speak.
Russian, Black Russian.
Okay.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. we say that they don't call themselves Black Russians. They call themselves Russians. But we know it's.
How was that outreach possible?
They are the children of those Americans who were African Americans dissatisfied with our country, and they wanted to become communists, and they did. And that was in the 30s. And these were their children.
Right. So there really were people who left the country to go to Russia to become communists.
That's right.
We had a lady by the name of Dr. Lillian Golden, G-O-L-D-E-N, in our home.
That's right.
And Dr. Lillian Golden, mother was white. She was Jewish. Her dad was African American. And her dad was from Alabama. Her mother was from New York. And the two met in college. They married. And they went to Russia. And Lillian Golden had a daughter, and her daughter was
she's a writer.
Her daughter was a writer, and her daughter wrote for the Boston newspaper.
Boston Globe.
Hilda. But we had a number of Russians on campus, and they of course didn't call themselves Black,
right.
They call themselves Afro-Russian. Mm-hmm. We got papers, I got papers at the house.
Steve Wonder has been there at ECC.
First ECC?
Yes. It was, there was that period when we had wonderful relationships with STARS,
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. One day, my secretary walked into the office, and she said, Dr. Matthews, a friend of yours on the line. I don't know who it is. I said, who does he say he is? She said, he says that he's Stevie Wonder. I said, nah. And I said, Leo, hand me the phone. She got me the phone. I picked up the phone and I said, hello, I don't know who in the world you are, but I know you're not Stevie Wonder. And he says, yes, I am. I am Stevie Wonder. I says, really? And he says, yeah, I'm Stevie, Doc. I'm Stevie. I said, no. He says, well, there's a friend of yours. Will you listen to a friend of yours? I said, yeah. He says, I said, who's the friend? He says, Harold Cox. I said, you mean Lieutenant Harold Cox, San Diego Police Department?
Oh.
He said, yeah. So Harold comes on the phone, and he says, Bob, it is Stevie Wonder. I said, okay, I believe you. And it was Stevie Wonder. And I said,
What was their connection? Why did he come?
He wanted to talk to the student body.
Yes.
Oh.
So I said,
inspired the student body.
So I said, sure, he can come. He says, we're on our way. I said, on your way? He says, we're almost there. I said, hey, look. I said, I'm going to dismiss the entire school. And we're going to have it outside. I said, auditorium's not going to hold everyone.
Was this at ECC?
Yeah. I said, the auditorium's not going to hold everyone. And I said, I got to get a stage from somewhere. And Harold says, it's on its way. It's on its way. He said, I've already ordered a stage. And I said, what do you need? All we need is someone to be constantly with Stevie Wonder and guide him. And Stevie Wonder came on campus, and he talked about drugs and, and how, why put this poison into your body and so forth. It was well received.
Did you attend? Ms.
Matthews? No, it was just teaching.
This
school day. Yeah. Another thing, ECC, that particular building, that particular campus, it took a long while for them to put that into the Southeast San Diego, but it's a wonderful resource.
It's a beautiful building.
And it really is. Yeah. And now, one of the things that I'm was hoping, well, here we have what we call the Educators. I don't know whether you have been there, and you should come. It's called the Educators Breakfast.
Oh, okay.
Bob and Walter Porter had the idea of, this is a good time to get those who are administrators at the four-year level, the university. And so that's what happens. There are about, 13 or 14 community college universities that are invited, and they're invited to bring at least 8 people from their staff.
Right.
Okay. And so that happens every year, and it has happened not since, 1980?
86.
Since 1986. Every year. And it's
the
Saturday before the parade. And it's always on ECC's campus.
Yeah, I would love to.
No, last 2 years it's been at Jacobs.
Oh, that's right.
It started on
ECC's campus. Now these 2 years, last 2 years, they're at the Jacobs Center. That's a wonderful thing.
That's great.
We were here when the March on Washington happened. And since we could not travel there, somebody, I don't remember who organized that march.
From San Diego.
The citizens of San Diego marched from Balboa Park to the county administration building. And then there was a speaker about being involved, about the injustices, about what Dr. King was talking about. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful, just kind of enjoyable walk from Balboa Park to...
For people who could not make it there, they still could participate.
Right. Yes, for people who could not make it.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful. I really want to thank you. Yes. I mean, amazing. Your mind is just incredible. You're remembering dates exactly. And this is just going to be wonderful for our students and for our faculty and for researchers. And I thank both of you, Dr. Matthews and Ms. Matthews, for coming and sharing with us here at San Diego State in the library for this oral history project. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for thinking of us.
Okay, we appreciate it. This is